Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. This week, my special guest is Billy Piper, star of stage, screen and music, and now writer and director of Rare Beasts, which opens in UK cinemas this Friday. Well, I'm delighted to welcome Billy Piper to the podcast. Billy, how are you?
I'm good. Yeah, I've just finished a film and just yesterday, so I'm now excited about having some time to myself, and the film's coming out, so that's all very exciting. So yeah, better than I have been, let's say that.
So you've been managing to work. I've spoken to a number of filmmakers who have managed to work during this. How does it work that, you know, with everything that's going on, that you can get work done?
It's different. It's, you know, it's kind of logistics heavy and lots of protocol and arguably less fun, I guess. But you can still make a film, it seems, in lockdown. So in many ways, we're incredibly lucky. But it's a completely different experience. And it's very, it's quite, you know, it's dispiriting in the way that you have to. You are all sort of closed off, caged up, and can't. There's less, you know, room for fun and play, I would say. Although we did manage to find some.
Is the thing that you've just finished the Lena Dunham project?
It is, yeah.
So tell us about it, or as much as you can say about it.
Well, what I can say is that it's like a medieval coming-of-age story that was based on a book that I never read as a child called Catherine Called Birdie. And it sort of documents this young girl. I suppose it's like a journal, this young girl coming to terms with becoming a woman and what that actually means for her. So it's very funny. It's very warm, and I would say it's a sort of a 12-year-old girl's dream film. But I would say it will appeal to families. It's working on many levels, let's say, and I think Lena's writing is able to achieve that.
And this is with Andrew Scott and Lena Dunham. Obviously, tell us about what it was like working with them.
Well, working with Lena Dunham was a dream come true, because I've been such a fan of hers for so long. And I feel like she's done an enormous amount of groundwork for other female writers and filmmakers. And so, yeah, I couldn't quite believe it, to be honest. It was one of those moments where you're on set with someone that you've watched and studied and stalked and pored over for years. And she's sort of everything you'd hoped and more. Incredibly bright, very funny. Just a great, great woman. Very talented, you know.
You sound a little bit starstruck.
I mean, that's an understatement. totally starstruck. And then obviously playing Andrew Scott's wife, which was also a really big professional moment. And I sort of feel like I've found two really good friends, but I would say that.
Yeah, tell me, I mean, I know this is, there's only one possible answer to this question, Billy, and it has to be yes, but is Andrew Scott as nice as we all want him to be?
Yeah, he's really, really nice, but he's also naughty. So, he, you know, the hot priest, you know, it's not, when you meet him, it's not such a stretch.
have you been watching Pursuit of Love?
Oh, I have. I love it.
Again, that naughtiness is, I think, to the fore.
Yeah, and he's very naughty in the film as well, in the film that we're shooting or just shot. Yeah, he's brilliant in that. I love that show.
So, look, let's talk about Rare Beasts. So, congratulations. Firstly, the first thing I want to ask you, tell me about the title. What does Rare Beasts mean?
Rare Beasts, I think I used it as a term to describe people I shared my life with in my 20s in a sort of, I guess it, it chalked up a certain type of person and a certain type of behavior, good and bad. And then when I started using it as an idea, I could sort of see rare beasts all around me. So that's why. It also just feels very loud, and so does the film.
Welcome to my life.
How long are you staying for?
Indefinitely. We should go and watch people being happy.
Every wife, respect your husband!
I'm what you call a post-post-post feminist.
Just an original woman.
What is going on here?
She used to be such a funny child. She used to write these little love letters and then often little death threats.
I want to unveil myself to you one piece at a time so that I can talk you through what I physically hate about myself.
You're broken, Mandy.
Watch me, watch me, watch!
I want a 5-hour day.
You believe in heaven!
I want to make stew that keeps.
I don't need to make stew.
Watch me, watch me, watch!
I want a man.
Man, will always send you mad, man.
Even though I feel scared and angry, I still love and respect myself.
So you've written, directed and starred in it. Describe for us the character that you play, because it may not be a character that everybody would immediately think, oh, of course, that's exactly who Billy Piper is going to play. So tell us about your character, and then we'll talk about the very early scene in which your character meets Leo Bill's character and they have one of the most awkward on-screen conversations that's brilliantly comedic, but also very... So tell us about your character first. Who is she? How has life brought her to the point that she's at the beginning of the film?
So I play Mandy. She is a modern woman. She is a single mum. She's professional. She a professional person. She's a nihilist. She's sort of broken down by her parents' relationship and trying to find her way through modern romance for what that means, and trying to be an empowered woman, but someone who really struggles with the ideas of modern feminism. So I guess that's her in a nutshell.
And she has this dinner with Leo Bill's character, who tells her very early on in the discussion that he finds women intolerable. But he then says, I find women intolerable, but I won't be without one.
Yeah.
Tell me about writing that line and where that comes from.
That line comes from... it comes from seeing the struggle that a lot of men I know have spent time with, that seems to be one of their struggles with women and modern relationships, I would say. It's like they find women such hard work, and at the moment, it's a very they talk to me about it being a very stressful time for men because they don't know quite where they fit into things and what their expectations are and what how they can or cannot behave, although it seems pretty clear cut to me. But And yet they want that security, and they want the good things that come with female company and companionship. And it seems to be a source of great confusion and upset.
Yeah, well, then your character, rather than responding by putting a napkin down and leaving the table, then actually stays and engages him in an increasingly... in a conversation in which there are several things going on, that it appears to be confrontational on the one hand and argumentative, but there's also something else going on in that conversation. Why does she stay? Why doesn't she just go, OK, I'm just not interested in somebody who says, literally, women are intolerable, but I won't be without one?
Well, I think quite often in life we can be drawn to people who say the worst things to us that we potentially think about ourselves or about the life in which we choose and live. But also, it's very rare that people put their cards on the table in that way. And it can be very compelling, and it can be on some level very attractive, even though it's kind of, it could be strange, perverse, rude. Also, I think there is a place, it's familiar to her because of her relationship with her dad. So it's a sort of, it's a chaos that on some level is attractive to her. It's also someone that appears to be strong, but is actually just very controlling and manipulative. So we can find ourselves in those relationships. Quite funny, when I speak to women who've seen the film, who sort of struggle with the character of Pete so much, because whilst they think he's an ass, they're also kind of attracted to him and his sort of acerbic views.
Tell me about Leo, because I absolutely loved him in Fabric, and I interviewed him on stage, and he was, really funny and really charming. And so tell me about him, therefore, playing a role in which he has to, at least verbally, be such a louse.
I've loved Leo Bill. I think he's one of our greatest. I've seen him a lot on stage and not enough on TV and film. And he does this thing very well. He is, he's very outspoken, Leo, but he's also incredibly vulnerable. And that's sort of a quality that I really liked for the role. He also he didn't seem to have a gender with the part. Like, he wasn't trying to make this guy more appealing to us. He seemed to, although he had compassion for his character, which I think on some level, maybe you want to find that suits your acting style. He leans into the darkness and the horror of the Pete, and he's not vain as an actor, and I really love that. And I think all of the actors in the film, there's no vanity in their performance. They seem to be very comfortable playing these sort of beastly people, and it's not about the way they look, and they're not trying to make themselves likable. And I really love that in the work that we do.
Stealing our lights, we're rotting here.
You're a vision.
Ooh, suspicious dress, darling.
Oh. As suspicious as that sermon.
I ruffled a few feathers, I'm sure.
Who chose them?
Oh, me.
Oh.
I know. I'm what you call a post feminist. Mm.
Just an original woman.
Oh, Mandy, how do you find the smothering?
Not as bad as the hateful honesty. Mandy, this guy, or these guys, this yes. guy, hell-bent on love.
Yeah, I hope his penis is as big as his heart. Oh, perfect.
take care of him, Mandy. He's a delicate flower,
right,
really.
You're making us sick now.
Oh, it's hard to see that sometimes, I know. But that's our gift as women. We can see through all that arrogance and rage. But don't love light and weaken our brand.
One of the people who is sort of most known for not worrying about playing unsympathetic characters is David Thewlis, who from the very beginning of his career has been utterly fearless in the roles that he's played. Tell us about David Thewlis' character and how you found him to work with. I should say that I met David Thewlis very briefly at the very beginning of his big screen career, and he directed a movie called he was in a movie called Resurrected, in which I thought he was brilliant. And then I met him at a party, and he was the scariest person I ever met. What? And it turned out he was, because he was in character making that Mike Leigh film naked, and he was right in the middle of that. And he, it was like he had that character with him. I mean, and I think he's a brilliant actor. Tell me about working with him in that role.
Oh, God, another dream come true, really, because I've been a devoted fan of his for as long as I've wanted to be an actor and a studied his work. And I worked with him on Craig Roberts' film Eternal Beauty, and I talked to him about my film, and I just thought he'd be brilliant. So I just sent him the script on the off chance, because he said take a look, and I thought, oh, I'll send it to him and he won't read it, or he'll come back for 3 months later, by which point we've probably cast the role, whatever. That's a sort of familiar pattern. And he got back to me straight away. He was very excited by the script and his character. And he was like, yeah, I'm in. And that was that. And I'm working with him. I love it because he's so big, so theatrical. And I think those sort of performances really help this movie, because it is theatrical. It's very heightened, and it's... And it wouldn't work with sort of naturalistic act. It needs big sort of punchy choices. And he obviously nails that.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tell me about, I mean, it's because you raise Eternal Beauty, and there is a stylistic connection between the two films about inhabiting a heightened reality, something which is, you know, there is an air of artifice and theatricality to it, but without cracking that point at which you don't believe in the characters. So tell me, did you learn stuff from working on Eternal Beauty? Tell me whether you think there's a connection between the two.
You know, I do think there's a connection, and it's kind of cosmic. This is when I believe in something other, because like I'd written the script in such fine detail that all of those abstract theatrical moments were there 7 years ago. But then I find myself being cast in a film that is also doing a lot of that work. And doing it in camera a lot, which is something I really wanted to do, and there wasn't money to do anything alternatively, but also that was the right choice. Craig's film does it really well, because whilst the thing about doing that stuff, I find as a viewer, is that, as you say, sometimes it is really cool and fun and immersive, but sometimes you can lose the emotion. You stop being emotionally invested, and I couldn't do that in with this film, because it's so much about emotion. It's all about emotion, really, emotion and madness. And so I did get I just saw him work, and that was really really helpful. And then I just studied the sort of references that I wanted for our film a great deal as well.
Can you tell me something about the music choices in the film? Yeah. Because the music cues play a really big part, and it's hard to describe. How would you describe the use of music in the film?
There's a lot of it.
Yeah.
Because I love, I guess because I love theatre and musicals and dance and all of that stuff from my youth filtered into this film in a way that I wasn't really conscious of, but I now see, having made it 2 years ago, how much of my childhood passions have leaked into the movie. So look, there's a lot of music. It's completely varied. Sometimes it feels quite vaudevillian. Sometimes it feels kind of Hollywood swoony strings, but it's doing a lot of opposing work. So in the moments that the protagonists are behaving, as always, kind of appallingly to one another, the music surrounding them feels kind of dreamy and lustful and like love will out. So it's trying to play with that. And then there's some like crooners in there as well. And I don't know, it's kind of mental. It's mental.
There was a point in it when I kind of imagined you in the editing room, because obviously I have an imagined version of how films get made, Billy, you know, it's directors basically do it. So I imagine you in the editing room looking at something and thinking, I wonder what the most contrapuntal piece of music I could put against that is, and going, yeah, let's try that. Because there are certain moments when it is almost as if the soundtrack is going this way when you thought the drama was going this way. And it's done on kind of hard cuts, which I enjoy very much. But when you say vaudevillian, I think that's the tone of that, isn't it? It's the sudden shift. And it also felt very, very confident. It felt like you knew what you were doing. Were you helped through this process by a brilliant editor, or is this all coming from you?
I had a brilliant editor, Hazel Bailey, and I felt like I was surrounded by really, really talented people. My partner did all the score and all the music, so we had a great shorthand, and it was just a very relaxing experience in that sense. But I just felt like I was quite convicted about most of those choices, because I feel like I made the film I personally want to see. And that's really the only instinct I could rely on, because it was such a new experience and something I've never done before. Obviously, I've worked as an actor for 20 years, and that has, you know, informed the work and helped me enormously. But I don't know, it just felt satisfying to me, and it felt immersive, which is something I really wanted it to feel like, and sort of chaotic and very emotional. And the film, the sort of pace of the film, the hysteria of the film, it feels like what was happening in my mind all day, every day, from my late 20s into my early 30s. The world felt so loud because my anxiety was so out of control. And it just felt pressure. And as much as that's about, you know, the expectations of women, that's also just about modern life. That's how it feels to me. It feels unrelenting. It's like a constant panic attack.
Are you generally an anxious person?
I didn't think I was at all. I spent my 20s thinking I was a hippie, and that when I had kids, I'd be this unbelievably relaxed parent. And into my 30s, I realized that actually I think at times I have like chronic anxiety. Yeah. But and I've been realizing that more and more throughout lockdown, obviously. And then I think I'm a classic case.
It's a funny thing. I mean, you know, anxiety. I've just recently, my kids are now grown up. They're 19 and 21. Uh-huh. And I love them. I'm very proud of them. But I've just started doing CBT because I'm an anxious person. And I finally, you know, my family said, for heaven's sake, get help. You know, but like in a kind of creative and productive way. And it's something I've resisted for a very long time. But it is... There is part of me that thinks, you know, anxiety is what I am. There's part of me that thinks that the world is actually fantastically anxious at the moment. And if you're not anxious, what are you doing with your life?
I don't know anyone who's not anxious. And I know that, like, we use this, the word, we band it around, but I don't think we band it around lightly. Like, I genuinely think we're all dealing with a great deal of that at the moment, understandably. But I really wanted that to be reflected in the film, even at risk of it being too uncomfortable.
Do you think that the film in the end is positive? I actually came out at the end of it feeling quite upbeat. I didn't come out at the end of it thinking like it was a panic attack, but I wonder whether that's just me. Do you feel that the film has a positive conclusion?
I feel like, yeah, I think it does. But I think, you know, my experience of life is that only small things change. Quite often when you watch films, and there are enormous changes by the end, but that doesn't ever feel real to me. I wish it were real, but it's not. The change is realizing that the thing that she needs to focus on is this, you know, her relationship with her son, and taking care of herself is kind of small off the back of all of the aggro the film has presented. But it is the way life is. It's often just walking away from something or someone, and it doesn't have this enormous, sort of 180. It's just, it's very subtle, but it takes enormous courage and enormous strength to do the things to make those changes.
Has making the film solved some things for you? Because, you know, when you write and direct and you're in control of a project like that. I don't know how much control you've had over previous works, but it sometimes making an artistic statement can quell a lot of the demons and anxieties that led to that statement being made in the first place. Have you felt that?
Yeah, I think so. And it'll be interesting to see it actually have a release, because it's been in my mind, this film, because of it's been pushed back so many times by COVID and... it sort of felt like I'd imagined making it, and actually now, like, it almost like a phantom film. And now that it's coming out, I feel genuinely quite emotional about it, because I think it does tie up a lot of, you know, even though it's not like directly lifted from my life, these are emotions that have been circling me for 10 years and thoughts that have circled me for 10 years and I think it is going to sort of, I hope so. I hope I'll feel something about it coming to its sort of culminating in a small theatrical release and people seeing it and experiencing it.
Presumably since, because you made it in 2019, am I correct in thinking that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So presumably since, it's been a period since then, the reaction, the critics, I haven't read, because I tend not to read other reviews before I watch something. It's all happened already. That's all happened. Or do you care what critics think? And are you waiting for reviews, or has that already all been and gone?
Well, it's annoying because it's sort of almost happened about five times. So it came out in Venice, but that turned into a bit of a mess because it was on the first day and we didn't get the right people at the right time, and that was very annoying. And so it didn't quite have the moment that I was hoping for. But we're at Venice, so that was feeling great. Then it was opened in London at the London Film Festival, and that had a small sort of review thing, I think. Although I think this is its moment where it's going to be unpacked and properly. And how do I feel about that? I feel like terrified because this is like all on me. I can't hide behind, well, you know, the writer did a shit job or the director was a scumbag. You know, I can't do that.
I once spoke to somebody who was a writer who had directed their first film, and they said that as a writer, all they had done was protected everything they'd written all the way through production. And as a director, they got on set and looked at the script and went, who wrote this shit? They said it was a completely different experience. How did you find directing your own lines?
I really liked it. I really liked seeing the actors say the lines. Annoyingly, I feel like being in it was an oversight because it meant that I couldn't fully relax into director mode, and that I was having to sort of switch between mindsets, which I found quite hard. I was also pregnant, so I was, let's just say I didn't have full mental agility. But I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. I mean, what I didn't realize or account for was the amount of sort of troubleshooting is involved. You know, as a director, you know, just putting out fires and getting the day and the sort of less romantic stuff. But it reminded me of being a mother a lot, being in directing, actually. It's just a lot of decisions all day long, whilst trying to stay calm and connected to your vision, which is often compromised under time sensitivity or financial sensitivity, which this film struggled with throughout.
Do you think that directing is something that you'll, I mean, does it feel to you like that's where you belong, or how does that sit with acting and writing?
I feel like I want to write and direct again, because I loved it, and I love acting. I really, really love acting, but it's, for me, I've got, it's finding the right thing, and they don't often come up, if I'm honest. You know, it's rare that you do a job that you just feel like this is it, this I can completely give myself to this, and I know this, and I have an axe to grind with this. But with the directing, I think it's very new and I feel very impassioned and I really want to work from the ground up and continue to do it. But it's not something you can, I just don't think you can just turn this stuff out. It's like you need to take your time. So hopefully I'll do it again. But I do love making things that feel really theatrical and kind of mental. And I think maybe I'll lean into that even more in the future. I really ultimately just want to be, to make musical films and pieces of choreography. I love it.
There is no higher aspiration than wanting to make a musical film. And of course, there are kind of key moments in the case of Rare Beasts in which it feels like it is about to become exactly that. And I'm a huge musicals fan, and I like the boldness of Rare Beasts. I mean, it's unusual for a first film to be quite so sure of itself, I think, which is no, but you know what I mean.
And
good for you, because I also feel that thing about you should make, you know, you said I made the film for me. I think you should make the film that you want to make, because otherwise, what's the point? But I do think it didn't, you know, it felt very bold and very confident, and I'm kind of slightly surprised to hear you talking about, you know, anxiety and uncertainty, because I don't see that anxiety and uncertainty in the direction of the film, although I see it in the character that you play.
Yeah, that's interesting. I feel like all the work I do sort of suggests that I am stronger than I actually am, I think, mentally. I think maybe it does. I think it's a place where I feel confident and like I know what I want to know maybe not know entirely what I'm doing, but I feel more sure. It's real life that I struggle with more.
Yeah. Well, look, Billy, congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
I wish you every success with it.
Oh,
I hope
thanks.
You do get to direct and write again. And I hope that, you know, at some point we get to meet in the flesh rather than on this virtual thing. But thanks ever so much. It's been a real pleasure speaking to you. And as I said, thanks. All the best with the film.
Thank you so much.
My thanks to Billy Piper, and thanks to you for listening to this Kermode on Film podcast. Rare Beasts opens in UK cinemas on Friday. If you've enjoyed the podcast, remember to subscribe and tell your friends. Also, visit our Patreon page, which has got loads and loads of video extras. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Keep watching the skies.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.